Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to the Infidel Guy show. Thanks a lot. Make sure you join us in the chat room. That's where we are. Okay, at infidelguy.com. Click on community and then click on chat. If you have any questions for me or my guests this evening, just type those in red. All right, and I'll try to relay those comments and questions to our two guests. On the phone right now with us, we have Dr. Robert Price, as well as Jeffrey J. Lauder. Both have been on the program before, and we know that Jeffrey J. Lauder is a co-founder of infidels.org, and Dr. Robert Price, well, his resume is, I think, is longer than I am tall, and you can check out more about him at his website, robertmprice.mindvendor.com. You can also do a search for Robert Price or Price at infidels.org. You can find out more about Dr. Price and Jeffrey J. Lauder. It's good to have these two guys back here tonight. Now, the topic this evening is we're going to talk about the empty tomb. And in fact, Jeff and Bob have both recently edited a book entitled The Empty Tomb, Jesus Beyond the Grave. I guess we'll find out more about that and their roles within this work. Welcome to the program, Jeff and Dr. Robert Price.
Great to be here.
Thanks, good to be here.
All right, well, The Empty Tomb, Jesus Beyond the Grave. Jeff, talk to us about this book. What's it all about?
Well, this book is really a book that I think I speak for both Bob and I when I say that it's probably long overdue. Christian apologists and scholars have been hard at work for a long time in providing sophisticated defenses of the historicity of the resurrection and Jesus. And while skeptics have certainly taken notice of this, and you can find criticisms of, you know, specific arguments here and there, there never really has been a book published, at least recently, that tried to provide even a semi-comprehensive answer to a lot of these Christian arguments. And The Empty Tomb was conceived to fill that need. I don't think that it's an encyclopedic comprehensive answer to every argument that Christians have advanced in favor of the resurrection, but I think it does make a pretty substantial contribution in addressing many of them, and certainly some of the most sophisticated and representative arguments for the resurrection.
Okay, excellent. Bob, you had a hand in this book as well?
Yes, so I admit, had I originated the idea, it would not be nearly so comprehensive as it is. When Jeff brought me the idea, it turned out that a number of the contributors, please correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, but a number of the contributors had been thinking about the idea and brainstorming, and a bunch of them had written this and that piece, but nobody really had enough time to put the thing together, whereas I do a lot of editing and agreed to take it on, and it's one of my favorite topics anyway. But if there is any major approach that is not addressed here, I sure don't know what it is. And Jeff is the one that made sure that there was no flank left exposed.
Really?
He came up with a number of interesting new topics that we got people to write about.
Okay. The title is Jesus Beyond the Grave. I mean, it's almost like a misnomer. Why such a title?
Well, it's purposely ambiguous. It's like raising a question without the question mark, and I deal with this in the introduction, an essay called The Second Life of Jesus. Any way you cut it, there is justification for saying that Jesus goes on. Now, does that mean his cause goes on, as some liberal theologians say, or that Jesus himself as a literal individual is still consciously alive somewhere, as obviously millions of people think, or does it mean Jesus as a lasting character is whether historical or not, literally alive or not, is he important? There certainly is a lingering discourse about Jesus. It didn't just stop with the grave, and so he remains a fascinating question that must be discussed, and then, of course, the book tries to do that in just about every possible way.
Hmm. Well, as you know, there I didn't even know the issue was... typically, I guess, on the end that I hear, I guess I don't hear a lot of scholarly argumentation, but the arguments I hear about for the resurrection and stuff like that, I just hear about the Bible, and that's pretty much it. Or I hear about maybe people who claim they knew of a Jesus who was crucified, and they use, you know, some very ambiguous references. What are some of the strongest arguments that people are positing for the existence and the resurrection, and, well, I guess I'd say the existence, the death, and the resurrection of this Jesus, and what are the rebuttals to them?
Well, I think the existence of Jesus is a subject that I know a lot of skeptics like to talk about. The reason that we took the approach that we did in the book is, as important as that topic is, you can accept, even if it's just for the sake of argument, that Jesus existed as some sort of a historical person,
okay,
but deny the resurrection. And really,
right,
the central claim of Christianity is that Jesus rose from the dead. It presupposes that the historicity of Jesus is true, that Jesus was a historical person. So really, the historicity of Jesus doesn't receive any treatment at all in the book, and that's by design.
Excellent.
In terms of the strongest arguments for the historicity of the resurrection, I guess there's two ways to answer that. And the one is, I'm not trying to be flippant towards sincere Christian believers, but speaking as someone who isn't a Christian, I mean, by definition, I don't think that there are good arguments for the resurrection, but some are, you know, less weak than others. And I think one that probably has attracted the most support among all stripes of Christian believers has to do with the alleged Jewish polemic reported in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 28, verses 11 through 15, where the author of Matthew reports that his Jewish opponents were insinuating that the Christians had stolen the body of Jesus, and that was offered as an explanation for the empty tomb. And the Christian argument that's based upon this is the idea that accusation, the accusation that the disciples stole the body, presupposes that the tomb was empty.
Right.
And they would not have made that sort of an accusation unless it really was. And so you can use that as sort of a starting point for a argument for the resurrection that would show that there was an empty tomb, and then they would try to bring in other points of data and argue, based on some sort of cumulative case or inference to the best explanation, that the historicity of the resurrection is the best explanation, and therefore it probably happened.
Sounds like you're saying that they're basically saying absence of evidence is evidence of absence, kind of thing. Like they're saying, well, of course, I mean, the number one thing you'd expect to find if if Jesus was real is an empty tomb. Hey, we have that. Or do they even have that? Bob?
Yeah, I find that argument, though it does have a kind of a, on the face of it, attraction, as Jeff says, it doesn't turn out to be a strong one, simply because it reads like a circumstantial ad hominem argument, which is a fallacious argument inherently, where you simply say, well, if what you say is true, it still doesn't make any sense. And it's like saying, look, I wasn't there, I don't know whether the tomb was empty or full or whatever, but let's assume you Christians are right and it was empty. There's obviously another reason for that. So I don't think the rejoinder that the disciples stole the body presupposes any knowledge of the tomb of Jesus one way or the other. In fact, I think a third century rabbi says, all right, what the heck, he rose from the dead, but Satan did it. Well, now, is that evidence that Jews believed for 300 years that Jesus rose from the dead? Obviously not. It's just saying, look, I don't care what you say, there's a response to it. So it really doesn't give it evidence of anything but catty interreligious polemics at the end of the first century. But I agree with... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to add on to what Bob said, which is that it's interesting to me as someone who's spent a lot of time studying inductive logic that there really has been no attempt anywhere in the world that I'm aware of on behalf of Christian scholars to formulate the argument for the empty tomb from alleged Jewish polemic in any sort of rigorous logical fashion. It's easy to go, read virtually any apologetic defense of the resurrection and find references to this argument, but you're not going to find it formulated in any sort of rigorous way. And I think if you try to do that, you're going to uncover all sorts of hidden assumptions and presuppositions in the argument. For example, even if the best explanation of the accusation of theft in the Gospel of Matthew is that some anonymous group of Jews could not deny the fact of the empty tomb and felt the need to come up with an alternative explanation, that wouldn't actually make it likely that the tomb was empty. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One of the issues is, when was the accusation made? A lot of conservative Christians assume that, these accounts are extremely early and you can assign all sorts of early dates. The critical question from the perspective of whether or not there was an empty tomb is whether or not you can date the hearsay that we're attributing to Jewish opponents of Christianity to before the destruction of Jerusalem, which happened around the year 70. And so there's actually a couple of ways that the Jewish opponents might not have been able to deny the tomb, the empty tomb. First, it could have been that they couldn't deny the alleged fact of the empty tomb because they were in a position to know if it was empty, and it actually was empty. But it's also possible that they could not have denied the alleged fact of the empty tomb because they were not in a position to know if the tomb was actually empty. And that would be the case if the hearsay did not originate or become well known until after the year 70. They might have even wanted to provide a true historical explanation for why the tomb was empty, but because this controversy was taking place so late, they simply weren't in a position to know. And it's not, and this goes back to the nature of the evidence at hand. It's not just that the Gospel of Matthew is giving what in legal circles would be called hearsay evidence. It's actually worse than that. It's a special type of hearsay evidence that we would normally call rumor or gossip, because we don't actually know the identity of the people who made the accusation of theft. It's not like it says Rabbi X, made the accusation. It just says Jews. We don't know if it was, the Jewish authorities. We don't know if it was right. Bob the farmer on the corner of 3rd and Main. We have no idea who made this accusation. So we can't even assume that this was actually the official Jewish response that Matthew's responding to. It could have just been the local Jewish community in the town where he was writing.
Yeah, in fact, I've never heard anyone else mention this before, Jeff, but that is an excellent point. The fact that Matthew says the people that came up with this, the conspirators, spread it around, and it spread all over among the Jews to this day, means this is among the diaspora. You have to think back to Matthew 23 also, where he makes this astonishing statement, "Woe to you Pharisees, etc., you crisscross the Mediterranean to make a single proselyte, and when you've got him, you make him twice as much a son of the devil as you are." Well, he's got Mediterranean diaspora, Hellenistic Judaism involved, so that's practically an admission that Matthew knows of this rumor, not even from Palestinian sources. So, it really, virtually every place you look, you find that, as Jeff says, I know how insulting this sounds, and it shouldn't, because we're just talking about historical hypotheses, but it seems to me there really are no good arguments for this. That doesn't mean it's a stupid notion or the people are stupid for believing it. It's just that it's only taken seriously because of the massive preaching of the Christian religion and the attention given it by apologists and preachers. If that were not the case, I think you would. The closest thing I think in a non-religious framework that is an analogy to this is the Roswell thing, where you have alleged eyewitness testimony, and it's already impossible to be sure whether it's worth anything and all that. But if it weren't because of the vast, huge existential and institutional context of it that makes it important, I don't think anyone would see any reason to believe such ancient reports.
Wow. This approach is so different than anything I've ever dealt with before. This interview is quite difficult for me, actually. I've never had anyone approach this the way you have. And some critics might even say, well, why would you even want to start at Jesus as a real person that existed? Is there any evidence for that? I mean, but I see that this book is obviously geared to those people. Well, I mean, obviously, this is a book, I guess, for skeptics, too. But you really want people who believe this stuff, obviously, to read this book. And that's why you're starting there, the resurrection. But all right, let's talk about the tomb evidence. Again, I guess the assumption is that there is a tomb. I keep hearing about this empty tomb. I saw a special on TV the other day where these people say they were pilgriming to the tomb of Jesus to see the empty tomb. Do we really have an empty tomb of Jesus?
No, it's a tourist trap Constantine and his buddies came up with. they had to, he decided that Christians ought to be able to make a pilgrimage to these various sites, and if you go there today, you'll find there's like three different Calvaries and so forth. I believe there's at least one other candidate for the empty tomb, and there was already no way to know where the original sites were, assuming there were original sites. I mean, I don't think we know, even if we take for granted that there was a Jesus, I don't think we know that he was crucified and entombed. I mean, all of these things are up for grabs. And so you can't even assume there was a known tomb of Jesus or that anybody knew what happened to him in the life of Apollonius of Tyana, who allegedly ascended to heaven and so forth. Philostratus says, of his ending or his passing from the earth or whatever, many stories are told, and then he gives one. And he says many varying stories are told. Well, that means nobody knows what happened to him. It's not that a bunch of different things happened to him. And so when you have an incredibly spectacular story of what happened at someone's death, that might indicate nobody knew what happened to him. And I think that's the case here.
Mm.
Yeah, this actually comes up in a couple of ways when you talk about the arguments for and against the empty tomb. Some Christians have argued that, the confusion about the location of the tomb is itself evidence that there was an empty tomb. And the argument goes like this. If Jesus had not risen from the dead, then his burial site would have been venerated as a shrine, because preserving the graves of Jewish holy men was extremely important, and so people would have remembered where it was, and probably there would have been pilgrimages to the site and that sort of a thing. But since it appears that that did not happen, that's evidence that the tomb was empty and Jesus rose from the dead, because if he did do that, then you would expect that, first century Jews and Jewish Christians and that sort of thing wouldn't have really cared about the location, because the bones weren't in the tomb. And from the perspective of first century Judaism, what mattered was where the bones were stored. And if he physically rose from the dead, there'd be nothing in the tomb, so it wouldn't be
exactly
as significant.
Right.
I think if you were to actually put this into, the argument into its logical form, which, again, I haven't actually seen anyone do up to this point, it's not at all clear to me that that argument works. I guess you could put it this way. You could say that, okay, on the assumption that Jesus did physically rise from the dead, we might not expect veneration, but at least as it would be at least as probable, if not more probable, that if he did not rise from the dead, we would expect this sort of thing. So it seems that the best-case scenario would be that this is a wash. It doesn't really seem to be evidence favoring, the resurrection over or the empty tomb over the hypothesis that the tomb wasn't empty.
Yeah, that's a very strange argument, and it's surprising who uses it, James Dunn and others do, because all the evidence we actually have of what people who believe in the resurrection of Jesus think about an empty tomb is they want to go see it. There's crowds of people there all the time at what is supposed to be the empty tomb of Jesus. So if that doesn't prove anything about the first century, but it's the only evidence we have, and it would certainly imply reply, well, you know, if they already, if, you know, the earliest people who believe in the resurrection would presumably be just as eager to visit the scene of the resurrection as we are today, and yet they didn't. So is the resurrection itself anti-tomb, a later belief? I agree with Jeff, doesn't prove anything either way, but if anything, it points in the other direction.
Well,
this is something, by the way, that reasonable people can disagree on. I think probably the one area where Bob and I may not completely agree with each other is that I actually think that there's a prior question that has to be looked at, and the question is this. Is it actually the case that the place that Jesus was buried in or at was never venerated as a shrine? Everybody in the literature seems to just take that as a given, that there was no veneration of the tomb in the first century, but no one's ever actually given an argument for that conclusion. So I don't know what to make of that. Maybe, you know, it really was the case that the burial place wasn't venerated as a shrine, either because he rose from the dead or he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but what I do know is that no one's actually given an argument. That's just an assumption.
Yeah, that is a fascinating point, yes.
And that's the point, by the way, you know, I'll put on my equal opportunity critic hat for a second. That's a criticism both of Christian apologists as
right.
well as some skeptics who would use the lack of veneration as an argument against the historicity of the empty tomb.
Yeah,
that first needs to be proved, and then we can talk about what that actually shows.
Now, isn't there evidence in the Bible that they were afraid that there would be grave robbers and people trying to steal the body and stuff like that anyway, so that... they're saying that this would have been kept secret anyway. That his burial would have been only known to a few people and not everybody anyway. What do you think about that, Jeff?
Well, I think it's a can of worms in the following way. I think that as I try to show in my chapter in the book, the question of was Jesus buried in it, and if so, in what way, turns out to be an incredibly complicated issue because of all of the, you know, the Roman practices surrounding victims of Roman crucifixion, and then Jewish laws regarding burial of condemned criminals, and you have to really get into the intricacies of what was historical precedent for the time.
Mm-hmm.
My own view is that the Romans probably did make an exception from usual practice and allow Jesus to be taken down from the cross and be buried as a Jewish criminal, condemned criminal, but that burial was not the sort of honorable burial that you see described in the Gospels. Jesus was buried dishonorably as a condemned criminal. And so in that case, you know, the location of the, that raises all sorts of questions about, you know, where would a condemned criminal under Jewish law be buried?
Good point.
Would that location be known by people and that sort of thing?
I would think he was if it was a criminal, definitely. Oh, yeah, I would think so, because they would have no reason to hide it, right? I mean, the authorities wouldn't have any reason. They would want to make it public information, I think.
Well, see, again, this is yet another example of an assumption that I think we really have to scrutinize.
Interesting.
And a lot of it depends upon who actually did the burial.
Right.
In my chapter, I actually describe one scenario. Certainly, you know, reasonable people can disagree, but I describe a scenario where Joseph of Arimathea, in order to get the body down by sunset, temporarily stored Jesus' body in his own tomb, but
right.
did not formally bury it there. Then, after the Sabbath had passed, sometime between the following evening and Sunday morning, he moved the body to its actual burial location, where it was, in fact, buried. Now, if that's the case, who would know what had happened to the body, including the temporary storage and the follow-on burial? Obviously, Joseph would. It seems reasonable to assume that Joseph would have had at least one helper, maybe Nicodemus, as mentioned in the Gospel of John, maybe others. So you've got, you know, at least two people, maybe three or four. The question is, if you've got those two, three, or four people who knew, you know, what had happened to Jesus' body in this whole sequence, who would have known about it? It may be the case, for all we know, that Joseph of Arimathea left the area and wasn't around not only to be asked, he wasn't even aware of the controversy until long after the fact. It could be the case that Joseph died, we really have no idea. Joseph of Arimathea sort of makes this cameo appearance in the Gospels. You don't hear anything about him before or really after. I don't know what you do with that. It seems hard to really draw any sort of strong conclusions based on the meager evidence that we have.
I'd like to point out that the fine summation of that case Jeff just gave is an example of one arguing exactly as we've described in the case of the claim that the disciples stole the body. Nobody in the debate really knows what happened, so you just find yourself batting back and forth possibilities, just as these Jewish opponents of Matthew said, all right, suppose the tomb was empty, why would that be? Jeff is giving the benefit of the doubt, saying, suppose Joseph of Arimathea really did obtain permission to take the body down, and suppose he really did bury. If that's the case, which none of us can ever know, what would be the implications? No one can argue any other way, and we can't get back to the truth of it, because it might just as well be, as some have suggested, that the Gospels are so late that they're all borrowing from Josephus the historian in this, and that the notion of Joseph of Arimathea requesting one of the three crucified criminals comes from Josephus, also known as Joseph Bar Matthias, who asked Titus to he recognized three friends of his from the ranks of the Galilean rebels on crosses, and now that he had turned coat, he asked the Roman authorities, could you cut them down for my sake? And if the three, one survived. Well, it may well be that this is one of several Gospel appropriations of Josephus, or it might be it's based on Priam going to Achilles to ask for the body of Hector. As Dennis McDonald said, any and all of these things are quite lively possibilities, and we'll just never know.
Interesting.
There's one other point I wanted to pick up on that was at the beginning of what Bob said, which has to do with sort of, you know, granting certain assumptions for the sake of argument. This ties back to the question of the historicity of Jesus. I know that, you know, that's a subject that a lot of skeptics like to debate, but I'd really like to encourage people, if this applies to anyone in the audience, to, you know, consider the idea of expanding their options. And the reason that I say this is, you know, imagine things from the other side of the table and assume that you are a young earth creationist who's trying to convince godless atheists that young earth creation, or to believe in God. If you wanted to convince an atheist to believe in God, would you try to get them to accept that the earth is young, and therefore evolution has to be false because there couldn't be enough time to explain the, you know, the complex ancestry of all living things? Or would you, option two, go for a much more simpler approach and bypass controversial assumptions that are likely to be, you know, ignored as preposterous by well-informed skeptics, just as probably virtually all of the skeptics in the audience believe the idea that the Earth is only 6,000 years old is not only false but stupid. We have to understand that from the perspective of many Christians, the idea that there was no Jesus is not only false but stupid, and if you put all of your eggs in that one basket, you're not going to be taken seriously.
Okay. Wow, there are tons of questions coming from the audience here. Back up to some of mine. Bob, was it commonplace to have your grave just sitting and ready back then? I mean, because you had a story of putting Jesus in someone else's grave. I mean, I'm thinking, wow, was it common back then to have your grave just sitting waiting for you?
I don't know, but it sounds reasonable. I mean, it's got narrative plausibility that apparently, at least we do know, that dug-out graveside tombs were coveted, and it was great to have one so that if bones were reburied, you know, it would be like finding a cheap apartment in New York. You'd be looking at the obituaries and trying to find one. Well, it's well imaginable that if a rich man wanted such a tomb, he would put a lot of money toward it and have it ready for when he went.
Oh, okay.
So that I have to admit, that does not sound odd to me.
Okay. This is a is kind of off the beaten track, but you kind of brought up Homer. So someone in the audience is asking, have any of you heard anything about Mark maybe being based on Homer epics? And you kind of hit on that earlier, Bob.
There's a great book on that. I find a number of the points plausible. The whole thing is plausible, but not convincing in every detail. And it's Dennis R. MacDonald of the Homeric Epics and the Gospel of Mark. It's from Yale University Press, 2000. And it's very fascinating, and he thinks that you can show numerous parallels throughout the whole of Mark to the Iliad and the Odyssey, and a number of them you can. I think it's just absolutely certain, for instance, that the Gadarene demoniac is Polyphemus the Cyclops, mm-hmm. and that the pigs that go into the lake, becoming the first known instance of deviled ham, that appears to have to do with Circe changing the troops of Ulysses into pigs and so forth. And so some of it is very strong argumentation, mm-hmm. Some of it not, but it's a great book.
Okay, now, gentlemen, we can use the Bible itself to talk about what, as you know, many people bring up the witnesses who witnessed the so-called resurrection and stuff like that. Do you talk about that a little bit in your book, Jeff, how the stories seem to contradict each other between the various books?
Well, we talk about, I guess there's a couple of points that I should make. The first is that there were no witnesses to the actual event of the resurrection itself, at least not according to the New Testament, insofar as it doesn't mention any, and the logic of the story kind of suggests that, when the people did see the risen Jesus, that they were seeing him for the first time. So there were no witnesses to the resurrection. What's claimed is that there were witnesses to the post-resurrection Jesus after he had, risen from the dead. People saw him in his resurrected state. And that is described a little bit in the book. That isn't necessarily the primary focus of the book, but there are, Richard Carrier has a extremely lengthy chapter where he talks about the spiritual body of Christ, and
in fact, that chapter is longer than the whole book. It's amazing. I don't know the physics of that, but somehow it's got more pages in it than the book does.
Okay.
So Richard Carrier has some things to say about that. Also, in Keith Parsons' chapter, as I remember it, it's largely directed at a couple of Christian apologists who have tried to provide a number of objections to the hallucination hypothesis, which some skeptics have offered to explain the data in the New Testament about the alleged post-resurrection appearances. So there definitely is material in the book on that, although I wouldn't say that it's the primary focus. Oh, and there's one other part of your question, which had to do with Bible contradictions.
Yes.
Off the top of my head, I can't remember a single chapter in the book that directly discusses the mm-hmm. issue of Bible contradictions, and I'll let Bob chime in on this as well. For my part, I'd like to think that was by design. I know that a lot of skeptics like to bring up contradictions in the Bible. In a very strict logical sense, however, that's actually irrelevant to determining the truth of the resurrection. To determine the truth of the resurrection, what we have to determine is whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. The question of whether or not the Bible contradicts itself, specifically on issues relating to the resurrection, is mm-hmm. sort of a secondary question. It could be the case, it's logically possible, that Jesus did rise from the dead, but the New Testament was written by, secondhand, it was written by people who were not eyewitnesses to the events that they describe, and the accounts were written, 50 to 100 years after the fact. I'm not saying, obviously, that that's what I think happened, but it's logically possible. And so it seems to me that the issue of Bible contradictions is really only a useful topic if you're dealing with an inerrantist who makes the claim that the Bible is inerrant. But here's the critical point. When you actually read the Christian's defense of the resurrection, I'm not aware of virtually anybody who argues the Bible is inerrant, therefore Jesus rose from the dead. What you actually find are arguments that say, well, even if we assume that the Bible does contain errors, it's unlikely that this particular verse is an error because it would have been embarrassing to the early Christian church, or it's unlikely that this is an error because this particular detail is confirmed by what we know about first century Judaism generally, or something like that. So even though it's probably the case that the majority of Christian apologists who defend the resurrection believe that the Bible doesn't have any contradictions, they're not actually making any arguments based on that assumption. So I think as skeptics, you know, we need to actually match up our responses to the arguments that are being made, and that's why we don't really go into the issue of contradictions.
Though in another way, it has become important in that, and I deal with this elsewhere. I have a couple of other books on the resurrection and the works, and one thing the contradictions show is that you're, in my opinion, is that you simply are not dealing with witnesses' testimony at whatever distance from the event, if there was one, and that's because the contradictions are not just random. They're of such a nature that one can tell from them that each story has been rewritten from an earlier version still extant in the Gospels. And there are patterns here that show redaction and rewriting, which show that you not only do not have independent accounts, but that they're literary accounts, not historical ones, not testimonials or depositions. And so what you see where the evidence of contradictions points, it's the issue is not, oh, well, if this were true, there would be no contradictions. No, that would be simple-minded, as apologists rightly say. But that isn't the issue. The issue is these, quote, contradictions, unquote, are signs of redaction and rewriting, which undermine the whole point of there being historical materials at all.
Yes. Yeah, I would have thought that would have been a seriously major point to bring up and to argue, because so many Christians that I talk to about with this particular issue, they always refer to the witnesses as proof that Jesus resurrected. And now I'm hearing from you guys that the Bible doesn't even explicitly say they saw the resurrection. I'm like, what?
Yeah, that's quite fascinating, yeah. Yeah, I know Richard Carrier's working on another whole book on the resurrection, and I have one that I hope is coming out in a year or so called Jesus is Dead, which is a collection of essays and reviews I've written on the topic, and another one I hope will come out from Prometheus eventually called Night of the Living Savior, in which I hope to deal with several of these often neglected questions. But you'd think this has been just beaten to death, but
right,
in fact,
right,
there are many underdeveloped and neglected aspects of this that I hope to deal with.
Yeah,
I just kind of need to get going and leave you with Jeff, but you're the winner that way because, unlike me, Jeff actually understands everything in the book. So leave it in his capable hands.
All right, Bob. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye.
Yeah, I actually largely agree with Bob's earlier point about contradictions giving you a clue into the origins of the document. I still think that from a strategic point of view, the focus of the book is correct insofar as, you know, the book is really directed at addressing, you know, arguments that Christian scholars are bringing up. But your point is well taken that, you know, if you talk to the average Christian on the street,
right,
they are making these sort of simple assumptions. And so, you know, the responses would probably be different than what you would use against a William Lane Craig or an N.T. Wright or,
exactly,
you know, whoever.
That's right. I mean, I've heard it so much. I have probably 20 Bibles here, and I've heard it so much, I began to believe it. Oh, okay. And I started arguing from how many people actually, you know, were there, and I started looking at the contradictions, and I never realized that, well, the whole thing's irrelevant because none of them saw it. I mean, we got a caller calling in here. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Brian. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. First question is, are the guests familiar with Dionysus supposedly dying on the cross hundreds of years before Jesus? That's the first question. I'll have you answer them off the air. The other question is, you guys have been addressing whether Jesus existed or not. And I've been accused online of having a one-trick pony. Now, my one-trick pony is, you know, when you're talking about the medical reasons, as described by the Bible, if you're going to be a literalist about the Bible, Jesus would have had suffered brain death and rigor mortis, had a lack of blood flow and oxygen to the brain for 3 days. We don't know of anything that can compensate for that. And there certainly isn't anything in the Bible that provides an explanation other than God did it. So, I mean, if you can address those two questions.
Thank you. Yeah, so basically, as Brian's saying, I guess, do you allow miracles? Are we starting with, okay, well, if the resurrection happened, so, I mean, you would have to give them permission to allow miracles to be a possibility.
Well, I think that I think there's a couple of points that I would make. What he brought up regarding the medical evidence, of course, is exactly right, and he's completely right. The issue is what you say about miracles in general, given certain background assumptions.
Right.
From the standpoint of an atheist or an agnostic, someone who at a minimum lacks belief that God exists and may even hold the positive belief that God does not exist, you know, the idea of someone going through all of that for 3 days and then coming back to life is so preposterous that it would seem that just about any naturalistic explanation, no matter how far-fetched, would be, you know, more probable than that.
Mm-hmm.
But from the standpoint of someone who believes that there is a supernatural being or supernatural beings, the idea of a violation of the laws of nature is not nearly as far-fetched. And so the way that one, you know, responds to a report of miracles is going to be largely affected by a person's worldview. And I'm not even saying this from the perspective of, everybody's biased and no one's able to, you know, break out from their presuppositions and look at things in an open-minded way. I'm simply saying that, you know, if your background information includes the proposition that there is no God, you know, then you're going to have one estimate of the probability of Jesus rising from the dead before looking at the evidence. Whereas on the other hand, if your background information includes the proposition God does exist, then you may very well have a very different estimate of the probability. So I do think that it's, you know, logically possible that a miracle could happen because it's logically possible that God exists. But when we say it's logically possible, all we're saying is that the probability isn't 0%. It might be 0.000001%, but it's not zero. That doesn't really get us very far, though, because all we've said is, okay, it's possible. Now we have to ask the follow-up question, is it probable? And that's where the background assumptions are going to come in. Obviously, as skeptics, we don't think it's even remotely probable. But even from the standpoint of a believer, say that, you know, you're talking about a person who does believe in God, even for a theist, alleged miracle reports should initially be treated with great skepticism. And a lot of the theistic philosophers will admit this, that even from their point of view, you should initially be extremely skeptical of these kinds of reports. And this is where, you know, the phrase extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence comes in. Yeah, it's possible that Jesus rose from the dead. The question is, you know, is there sufficient evidence to overcome its intrinsic absurdity? And you obviously know where I stand on that. The caller's other question had to do with Dionysus. I'm definitely familiar with that, and I know that Dr. Price is extremely familiar with that. And I'm not sure how he would answer. For my own part, I don't think that that's a very fruitful approach for dealing with the resurrection, because I think if you're going to offer that as an alternative explanation for why we have the stories in the New Testament that we do and why people came to believe that Jesus rose from the dead, you incur a certain burden of proof as the skeptic. And now all of a sudden you have the burden of proof to show that, you know, this belief was held prior to the belief in the resurrection. You have to show that the people who believed in the resurrection were familiar with that belief system. It makes a bunch of assumptions. Mm-hmm. And again, the argument may be true, but no one's ever really constructed any sort of rigorous logical argument to show that that's the case.
That's a very good
I'm
point.
I'm certainly not aware of one.
That's a good
point. So that's not an approach that I personally would recommend anybody take.
Right. That's a very good point. Yeah, I haven't. I've always seen people comparing and say, oh, look at this. Isn't this just like this? Like, yeah, great. But every time I read one of these, I'm always like, okay, but what else? I always find myself.
And where's the evidence? I'm not saying that the evidence doesn't exist. I don't claim to be an expert on this particular topic. But what I've noticed the few times that I've done any reading on this, the skeptics who will say, yeah, we can explain belief in the resurrection by parallels to the mythical religions, you know, good luck trying to find a whole lot of footnotes in that particular essay on the subject showing that here's a reference in this ancient text that was written this many years before Jesus allegedly rose from the dead, and it was in this geographical location that, you know, would have ultimately led to first century Jews coming in contact with the belief and that sort of thing. So it just seems like it's making a whole bunch of assumptions without a whole lot of evidence to back it up.
Yeah. All right, in the chat room, we got a question here from someone. It says, by Ratio, he says, Jeff, what do you think is the most plausible naturalistic explanation for the resurrection story? Carrier thinks it's the spiritual resurrection concept. What do you think?
That's a good question. Richard Carrier is an extremely smart man, and I'm sure that if the two of us were in a debate on this subject, he would absolutely be the winner. He has a command of ancient history and the relevant languages that I, you know, I'm no match for him on that. I think, however, my opinion's probably a little bit different. I think that, you know, if we were only going to focus on the empty tomb, I think the explanation I gave in the book is probably the best one, which would be that the body was temporarily stored by Joseph of Arimathea in his tomb and then later moved to the graveyard of the condemned where it was buried. The problem with that theory is that it doesn't attempt to explain the evidence of the post-resurrection appearances or why, you know, Christianity sprang into existence and that sort of thing.
Interesting.
The one theory I've seen that actually explains all of the data would probably sound pretty incredible to people who haven't read the PhD dissertation that defends it, but there is a philosopher by the name of Robert Greg Cavan who got his PhD at the University of California at Irvine. Cavan defends a hypothesis known as the twin hypothesis, where he shows that Jesus had an unknown identical, or he doesn't show, but he argues, I guess would be the more accurate word, he argues that Jesus had an unknown identical twin brother who was accidentally switched at birth, grew up in a different town, completely unknown to Jesus, Mary, or the disciples, and then after Jesus died on the cross and was buried, faked the resurrection as a hoax. And that explains a lot of things that have traditionally been a problem for the old school skeptical explanations. It explains why there was an empty tomb. It would explain why people thought that they had seen Jesus risen from the dead. It would explain why the Christian church moved the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. It explains virtually all of the evidence, and I know that there's a couple of sort of side issues that are discussed. For example, if I remember correctly, Cavan argues that the Apostle Paul's alleged, you know, sighting of the risen Jesus was actually a hallucination. And he points out, I think he points out, that argument goes through even if all of the traditional objections to the hallucination hypothesis are correct, because usually when Christians attack the hallucination hypothesis, what they're really focusing primarily on is the idea that there are all of these different, you know, groups of people who saw the risen Jesus, and hallucinations can account for that. Well, that's very controversial, and in the book, Keith Parsons, you know, provides a skeptical response to that. But even if we grant that argument about hallucinations for the sake of argument, that doesn't really address whether a single person could have experienced a hallucination. And in the case of the Apostle Paul, the hypothesis is that Paul hallucinated the risen Jesus, and that's partially supported by, you know, the very things that the New Testament has to say about Paul's alleged sightings of the risen Jesus. So, like I said, you know, this hypothesis probably sounds crazy, maybe even comical, but if you were to actually investigate it and go get a copy of the actual PhD dissertation and read it, it's it's a heck of a lot stronger than you might expect.
Right,
so
I would
encourage people to keep an open mind until they've actually read it for themselves. And he's coming out with his, and there's a lot of people apparently writing more books on the resurrection in skeptical circles. We've heard that Richard Carrier and Dr. Price are both working on other books on the resurrection. I also know that Dr. Cavan is working on a book on the resurrection himself. So pretty soon you won't have to go track down his dissertation. You'll be able to buy that book in about probably another year and a half to 2 years.
You have someone in the chat room arguing that, I never heard this because I thought they did just fine, but someone is saying here that the apostles didn't even recognize Jesus. Is there any strength to that, that Jesus wasn't even recognized?
I have to go look it up in my Bible. I think that there were one, if not a couple of alleged appearances where initially people didn't recognize him. It seems like off the top of my head that in the Gospel of John, I want to say it was the Gospel of John, that Mary did not initially recognize the risen Jesus.
Interesting. But how do we know which one that one was? No,
yeah.
There's like, what, 3, 4 Marys? Who knows? Sometimes it's hard to know which one. You switch them up so much. Okay, yeah, that'd be an interesting question to ask Bob, too, probably this Sunday. Hey, okay, now, evidence of Jesus dying, period, on the cross. Do we have any extra-biblical or historical evidence at all that the Romans or whoever or the Jews sentenced to death some person?
Yeah, well, yes, we do. I'd have to go look it up. I want to say it was Tacitus, but I actually believe that question begs the question, because I don't think that the standard should be, is there extra biblical evidence?
Really?
You know, I think that our skepticism has to be proportioned to the extraordinary or ordinary nature of the claim. The claim that Jesus died on the cross is not an extraordinary claim. We're not talking about a violation of natural law. It is not a miracle.
Right, I agree.
It is not, it doesn't go against what we know about things that were happening at the time generally. So it's not really clear to me why this would be treated with such skepticism. So if the Bible, you know, happens to say that that Jesus was crucified, given that it's not really an extraordinary claim to begin with, I'd probably just go along with it. Now, if we had some reason to be suspicious of a crucifixion, then that would be a different story. But I'm not really sure what the reason is that we should be suspicious of the crucifixion in the first place.
Well, I guess one thing that would probably drive my suspicion would be if there aren't any records of anyone ever being killed that way. But now we hear that story all of a sudden just for Jesus in his particular case.
I understand. So we have plenty of extra-biblical attestation to crucifixions, and I actually cite the ancient sources in my chapter of the book. I mean, it's well known not only that crucifixions happened, but this was something I didn't know about until I started doing the research. There's even evidence that the Romans practiced what I call large crucifixions that could literally involve, no kidding, thousands of people being crucified at the same time. And this was done during periods of open revolt, where the Romans wanted to send a strong message. Part of the punishment, you have to understand, from the time period, part of the punishment of crucifixion isn't just that you're dying in a really horrible and painful way. It's the shame that was associated with crucifixion and the deterrent that it provided. You know, it's one thing to read in the newspaper or come home at night and watch the news and hear that someone was given lethal injection. It'd be another thing in the first century to be walking along the highway And, you know, over there on the right, 15 feet up in the air, is someone who's been on a crucifix for 5 days.
Yeah.
And what kind of, you know, experience that must have been.
Yeah, I mean,
so there is a major, you know, there is a major effect with that. And in any case, you know, this is well documented. So I don't really see any reason that any rational person would deny that that was something that happened at the time.
Okay. We got a caller just called in. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Bridgie. Another great show tonight. I'm calling from Charleston, West Virginia again. A couple things, as I was listening in on the phone, when you picked up the phone, I think your guest brought up a very good point. That sort of takes us back to the whole question of whether there really was a tomb or not. Because basically what he alludes to is a heavy documentation to show that as a form of execution, crucifixion was more than just that, a form of capital punishment, but it was
intimidate.
It signified the depth of the crime there. So Joseph of Arimathea, if he were to have been successful in actually being able to appeal to authorities to have Jesus taken off the cross, he would have had to have extraordinary influence, not just with Romans, but with the Jews as well.
I don't know.
Mitigates against, to me, it mitigates against it. That's not to say it's impossible. I mean, almost anything is possible.
Right.
Gospel stories. But it mitigates against the fact that there would have been a tomb in the first place. And because of that, you know, as I think Dr. Price mentioned earlier, we don't know anything about Joseph of Arimathea. He sort of takes a cameo role in the gospel stories, but he might have really had to have been somebody.
Right, that's a good point.
In order to have pulled that off.
Right.
The other point that I wanted to bring up was that I think that the whole question of the tomb is primarily a kind of a literary one, in the sense that it's kind of hard to explain, but it is it's a symbol that is related to other symbols in the ancient literature of the time. I read Dr. Price's first book on deconstructing Jesus, and he mentioned a lot about confusion, and also the fact that there was confusion about whether Jesus could have been replaced. Hugh Schoenfeld, in his book, The Passover Plot, that deals with kind of a switch, and there was confusion, kind of like in Romeo and Juliet, also in The Tale of Two Cities. There's a misidentification, some people seem to believe that, there was a tradition that the church ultimately suppressed, that it was Simon of Cyrene in the Synoptic Gospels. In the Synoptic Gospels, not in the Gospel according to John, but the Synoptic Gospels, it was Simon of Cyrene who was sort of pulled out of the crowd and made to carry the cross to Calvary.
I mean, basically, are you saying, is it possible this man ended up carrying it all the way and Jesus slipped away? Are you about to say that?
And there was some administrative difficulty because there's some allusion to this in Islam as well, that Jesus never died on the cross.
I was going to ask Jeff that in a minute, but you've been on for a while. Let me go and let you go. I'll get him to address these two points. All right, thank you. Okay. First of all, taking Jesus off the cross. How unusual is that?
Well, again, this is something that I actually discuss at great length in the my chapter in the book. We actually have quite a bit of extra biblical evidence to support this sort of precedent. crucifixion was an extremely brutal form of punishment, capital punishment.
That's right. We've all seen Passion of the Christ, so yeah.
In general, the Romans did not allow victims of crucifixion to be taken down and buried. After the person died, the corpse would literally rot on the cross and would become, you know, food for the crows.
That's right.
On the other hand, we do have documented evidence outside of the New Testament of exceptions to this practice from a number of non-Christian writers, including Philo, Josephus, Plutarch, and Cicero. And I actually cite the ancient texts in my chapter. And what's interesting is that the documented exceptions to the general rule of not allowing burial for victims of crucifixion fall into, you know, one or two patterns. It appears to be the case is that if a person was crucified as part of a small crucifixion, in other words, if they were not part of hundreds or thousands of people being crucified at the same time during a period of open revolt against Rome, that would be considered a small crucifixion. So if someone was crucified as part of a small crucifixion, the Romans would be open to the idea of allowing someone to be taken down and buried. We also know, again, from extra-biblical evidence, that if a friend of the Roman governor, or if there was if a holy day was approaching, that those would be the kind of situations in which the Romans would allow a person to be taken down and crucified. We know this from extra-biblical evidence. And as it turns out, when we look at the specific case of Jesus, you know, this was at the time of the Jewish Passover. So it was at a time when the holy day exception was relevant. It was not during a time of open revolt against Rome, and therefore there's absolutely zero evidence to believe that there was a mass or large crucifixion happening at the time. So it's actually quite plausible to accept the Christian claim that, in fact, an exception was made for Jesus and he was taken down from the cross and buried. Now, what kind of burial, that's a totally separate question. But was there a burial? I would argue that it's highly probable that Jesus was, in fact, buried.
Okay, interesting. Let me take this caller, then we'll go back to the Simon question. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is Dungeon from the chat room.
Hello, Dungeon.
I saw a program on, I think it was the Discovery Channel recently, where they took a guy, a pretty strong-looking guy, and showed that it was actually impossible for
a human being to carry those heavy crosses?
Exactly, yeah. Even just the cross member, he had a difficult time, maybe 100 yards or something like that. And we always hear these stories about how...
Walking through the city? Yeah, it could be important. Yeah. That's interesting.
Huh. Yeah, I've always wondered the same thing, and you know, it may be the case that he was crucified, but you know, the part of the story about him carrying the cross through the streets is not historical.
Bit of an embellishment.
Seems pretty far-fetched to me if you take the entire story at face value that he, you know, was virtually killed before he even got on the cross with the flogging, and then after all of that, he somehow was expected to carry the cross through the streets and then did it. That part of the story definitely seems far-fetched.
That is pretty wild. I mean, I remember thinking about that when I was a kid. I remember thinking, damn, that must be heavy.
In fact, if you watch, I'm not going to say that the movie's historically accurate or it isn't, but if you were to watch Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, and you actually see the brutality of the, you know, the violence that was perpetrated against Jesus as depicted in the movie, it just seems to, you know, go beyond credibility to say that, you know, you could go through all of that and then carry anything.
But you know what? But he was more than a man. And that's the logic that I had when I was a kid. I went, well, he must have been powerful. He must have been like Hercules or something. And I remember thinking that when I was a kid. And I think that's the way they'll just justify it. They'll brush it off like that, that he just had this power, this inner power of God in him, and he was able to still do this because he loved us so much. And, you know, that's what we will get. We'll get that emotional appeal.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. By the way, I'm going to have to step off fairly quickly.
Okay, no problem. We'll take care of this last question here, and then I'll let you go. Now, Simon, he said, the caller before this last one mentioned something very interesting, and I think we've seen it in some comedy movies, I think like Monty Python's Life of Brian, where it's possible that, what if someone else took the cross? That's an idea. What if someone else took this cross for Jesus, like died for Jesus. Like, he really thought this guy shouldn't die and picked up the cross. I would think even in that story, that wouldn't make sense. I mean, surely, if this really happened, there were guards watching him. They're like, what are you doing? You're not going to carry this guy's cross and, you know, whip him back into the crowd or something. But anyway, well, what do you think? Is it possible that maybe Jesus
died? As far as literally physically carrying the cross, you know, yeah, that very well may have happened. But in terms of who was actually put on the crucifix,
right,
you know, if you accept the logic of the story, you know, there was a reason that Jesus was put on the cross in the first place, and it seems
right.
pretty far-fetched given the context that someone, you know, would have been allowed to take his place. You know, they might have allowed him to carry it, but they would not have allowed him, being somebody else, to actually go on the cross in the place of Jesus.
Okay. Well, all right, the title of the book again, Jeff, and where can we get it?
I'm sorry, the title of the book is The Empty Tomb, Jesus Beyond the Grave. And you can get it by going to, you can go to Amazon.com. You could go to secweb.org. And I've actually got a special web directory set up just for the book on my homepage. If you go to www.infidels.org/TildeJLowder, J-L-O-W-D-E-R, /empty tomb, as all one word, you'll see a special directory that I've created for the book.
Excellent. Good. Well, thank you very much, Jeff. I really appreciate you and Bob appearing on a program to talk about The Empty Tomb.
Well, thanks a lot. As always, it's great to be here.
All right. I'll talk to you another time.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, all right. Interesting. I have tons of notes. I thought about that, too, at the same time, though. I remember thinking, well, what if they recognize them, though? Well, what if they look very similar? That's a possibility. I mean, isn't that something? I mean, what if they did look alike? I mean, what if the guy who took the cross from Jesus looked just like him? I mean, come on, to the Romans, all Jews look alike. How do they know? I'm just kidding. Surely the Jews who convicted him would have recognized him, right? Or would they? I mean, how close were they to Jesus, really? I mean, come on, they just heard about this story of some guy doing something. I mean, is it possible? It's not like they had IDs back then. You know what I mean? It's not like you can, okay, here's my social security number, here's my ID. I mean, hey, maybe it is possible, though. Who knows? Because that's also a point. Maybe they didn't even recognize him. Maybe it really was someone else. Or I like the other idea someone brought up. Maybe they did kill him. He didn't come back. Somebody moved the body. And someone else claimed he was the Messiah. And people said, huh? You know, his apostles were like, somebody elbowed him. Shh, shh. Oh, yeah, I won't believe you're Jesus until I see the holes in your hands. Oh, okay, here's Jesus. He came back, everybody. I mean, of course. I mean, that's what they wanted. Because think about it. I mean, the whole belief system would be a wash if he didn't come back, right? The whole thing was based on that. So, of course, he'd have to come back. That's just part of the belief. It's kind of hard. Sometimes beliefs go further than the individuals that start them, don't they? We see that happen all the time in religion. But yeah, the whole thing about carrying the cross, yeah, I thought about that before as a kid. I've been thinking, man, that thing is so heavy. There's no way a human being could carry that thing. But wow. Well, anyway, thanks everyone for listening and watching. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Interesting program. Some of the historical stuff was kind of over my head, to be honest. But I learned quite a bit. I think the more I keep having these guys on, hell, I'll be the one iterating some of this stuff to you and talking about this stuff more in depth myself. Not quite sure I agree with a lot of the ideas, but hey, I don't have anything better. But it's nice listening to all these various opinions and ideas and researched work people have done about the whole thing. And it's good to know that you can be a skeptic and still research this stuff as objectively as possible and not just dismiss every single claim just because you don't believe. So I found that very interesting. It's good to hear that he's really looking at this in a very honest way. So cool. So it's a possibility that somebody named Jesus might have existed and that he might have died, but there's just not much evidence that he resurrected and came back. However, if he says you don't need extra biblical evidence, why believe the Bible? In order to believe the Bible, you got to look at the internal contradictions. You have to. It's unavoidable to determine whether or not he came back or not. I think that's important. And I think Bob kind of agrees with me too. Because it kind of comes back to that, doesn't it? I'll talk to you all another time. Thanks for listening and watching In Reason.